I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate. This Friday, The Guard opens at the Empire, Angelica, and Lincoln Plaza Theaters here in New York City. Written and directed by John Michael McDonough, The Guard draws on a couple of different genres. There's crime, there's mystery, and there's the unlikely pairing of two main characters to solve both of those. But it's also a comedy that toys with all the conventions you'd expect in a movie like this. The criminals quiz each other on philosophy in their getaway car. The setting is the bleak and beautiful coast of Ireland, and the central character is an Irish cop who plays dumb. But as his foil, a black FBI agent, says in a pivotal scene, "I don't know whether you're effing stupid or effing smart." And the movie is a symphony of profanities, that one in particular, but we won't say it because we're on the radio. The cop, Jerry Doyle, is played by Brendan Gleeson, and the FBI agent, Wendell Everett, is played by Don Cheadle, who is here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I think I'm probably not the target audience for this film, but I have to say I roared through the entire thing. I don't usually go to see movies about cops, but I'm so glad you came in today because I had a chance to see this one. And I can't remember when I laughed out loud as much as I laughed at this.
See, I think you are the target audience.
Maybe I am, right? I'm not in the demographic that one would expect. But
right. One
of the things I loved was the interplay between your character and Jerry Doyle, played by Brendan Gleeson.
Boyle.
That's right. And sometimes when it's shouted, it's hard to know which is which. And it's often shouted. But it was listening to the two of you play off each other was like hearing two jazz musicians trade solos.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, it seems like the two of you are on completely different kinds of music.
Right.
But as you listen closely, there's this kind of interplay that develops. How did you develop that as actors?
I mean, it was something, it was a case where I read the script and I was hooked immediately. I mean, from the first page, I was laughing out loud. And I remember reading it with my wife and showing her scenes, and we were both just cracking up as we were. She's an actor as well, so we were reading things together and just laughing through the whole piece. And it was the kind of movie that, you know, you couldn't anticipate what was about to happen. And that's not often that you get a script and that's in that kind of shape right off the bat. So then John Michael McDonough was here and not here, but in my perpetual state of Los Angeles in my mind. He was came to Los Angeles and Brendan was coming out to receive the Golden Globe for Churchill. And we didn't have a lot of time to rehearse because both of us were on opposite sides of the country and opposite sides of the world, actually. And he said, "Why don't we get together in my hotel suite and just kind of go through some of these scenes?" So we met at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and it was evident inside the first, you know, minute and a half that, I mean, I'd had an affinity for him already just seeing his work on screen, but, you know, and I thought, this is going to be a great guy. And we met, and inside of a minute, we really dug each other and clearly saw the same and had read the same script and saw the same humor and really understood who our characters were. So that part was very easy. Right off the bat, that happened.
You know, you mentioned something about there were things that you just wouldn't ever expect. And I often wonder this about actors, and you have a particular role in this. You have to react to things that you know because you've read the script, but your job is to be taken by surprise just the way we are in the audience.
Right.
How do you do that as an actor? How do you play with that?
I mean, you never know that you've done it successfully, or I never know that I've done it successfully. I'm always walking away going, "Oh, man, I hope that played." You know, and I think probably most actors have that same concern of keeping it fresh and trying to make sure you're experiencing it for the first time so the audiences can experience it for the first time as well. But like I said, the script was so well crafted that there weren't a lot of, traps that you had to worry about. It was really clear who they were, how they interacted, and what the sort of arc of this relationship was going to be.
The Brendan Gleeson character, Boyle, has been called racist by a number of reviewers, but it seems much more complicated than that. And I want to play a clip that we've got, because the two of you meet when your character is presenting to a room full of Irish cops, and Boyle makes this incredibly racist comment. And that he keeps that up throughout, but
right. There's
a lot more underneath that. And let's play a clip of you and Boyle, so Everett and Boyle, talking on the morning after you've been thrown in to work together. So you're at breakfast. Let's listen to that.
Kenosha, Wisconsin, you were saying. Did you grow up in the projects?
What?
Did you grow up in the projects? Or did it not have the projects in Kenosha, Wisconsin?
No, I did not grow up in the projects. It might surprise you to learn, Sergeant Boyle, that I actually come from a very privileged background. And by privilege, I mean prep schools, Yale. I was a Rhodes Scholar. You know what a Rhodes Scholar is?
I do know what a Rhodes Scholar is.
Really? Enlighten me.
Chris Christopherson.
Yeah. Chris Christopherson was a Rhodes Scholar. You are correct.
Privileged background, huh?
Summer in the Hamptons, skiing in Aspen, that kind of thing.
Skiing, yeah? I thought black people couldn't ski. Or is that swimming?
One of the things that struck me about that scene is it's about the silences. It's about the way that your character is waiting right. to see what's he really saying? What's yeah. he really thinking?
Yeah, say your next one. Come on. I know you got another one front-loaded.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's, it's one of these things where it's if he were actually bigoted and if he actually believed the things he were saying, it wouldn't be funny.
No.
It's clearly that he's trying to get a rise out of this guy, and he's going to say whatever he can think of to make it work. And I guess the question becomes, is it still racist when you say it if you don't believe it at all?
And you see this character doing it with everyone. He's playing off of his kind of physical image of a kind of big,
dumb
guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when he says things, people take it as, oh, wow, this is kind of, but he's not a big, as your character says, is he stupid?
Yeah, are you
or
stupid
or
are you
smart?
Really smart? And I think that's what is revealed clearly throughout the movie, not to give anything away, but we come to understand him more and more. But I think it's great because every character in the movie has these biases, which they just spout out there. And it's more about John Michael McDonough's, you know, the writer-director's desire to play with people's preconceived notions and misconceptions than it is about these characters at all. We become the vehicle for his sort of id, I think. But it's, you know, one of my favorite lines in the movie is when our characters come together and we're looking at surveillance tape from the bar. And there's been this thing earlier where Boyle's character has said, you know, are you Italian? He asks this guy, he goes, you look Italian. You know, like, what does that mean? But he says, you're Italian, you look Italian. And later we're looking at the surveillance tape and he goes, it's the guy right there, Devaney. And I go, oh, the Italian? You know, it's like they all have these biases. And it's just, I think it's funny to pull them up in that way and shine the light on them and play with it as opposed to being in some sort of a PC universe where nobody says what they're thinking and everyone's just like closeted in their preconceived notions and prejudices.
Yeah, and that is so clear that the writer and director is playing with that with everyone from Boyle to your character who quickly realizes he needs Boyle because every door he knocks on, nobody speaks English.
That's right.
And your character ends up interrogating a horse.
Yeah. Please, somebody talk to me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And you know, as far as the big question goes, I mean, you look at the person that he has entrusted with the care of the person who's obviously the closest to him in the film, his mother, it's a black doctor. So you start going, you know, he's more than what he seems, and this package is a little more varied and layered than is being presented.
And even the mother is not who you would expect. There are extraordinary scenes between the two of them.
Yeah.
And I remember one where they're talking about something illicit that the mom wants to do. You know, I can't believe the doctor's going to let me do this. And he says, well, I told him I'd deport him if he didn't let you out.
That's
so
right.
Even there, it's all played
yeah,
with.
Yeah, it's all played with.
But that, you know, the mother was one of the unexpected things to me as a viewer. Suddenly, as you say, you see this other side of this character that is so quickly explored.
Right.
Because the mother is an unexpected character in and of herself. She's much racier than you'd expect mom at that age
yeah.
to be.
And then you very quickly understand the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree and who this guy is and the way he's grown up. And I love that the characters, he's literate.
Yes.
He's a cinephile.
He knows that Chris Christopherson was a Rhodes Scholar.
You know, he's a smart, he's an intelligent guy who's like, I'll play Archie Bunker for you if that's who you want to see. But I'm not Archie Bunker.
All of the characters, though, seem to be about what's hidden and what's revealed. Even your character in that scene in the bar, your character is wound pretty tight. Yep. And there are moments where he says to Boyle, you shouldn't be telling me this.
Right.
But suddenly in the bar, and it is an Irish film, you get drunk. And when I watched this smile on your face, you look just like a 14-year-old neighbor of mine with a really mischievous secret. And it was like, oh, that's who's really underneath this person.
Definitely. I mean, and when you look at my character, he's named his kids Stokely and Huey. I mean, that's he's trying to say something about who he is as well. You know, so everyone, that's what's fun about playing parts like this and seeing scripts like this. Everyone really has a depth in their character, and there's really a lot to pull from. Even the, you know, sort of psychopathic, you know, bad guys in this, they're very layered. And, you know, there's the guy wants to be clear that there's a difference between a sociopath and a psychopath. I'm not sure what it is, but I've been told it's hard. It's a tricky difference, but I'm not the worst one. I'm the better one. So it's like, it's just really funny stuff all the way across the board.
I'm speaking with Don Cheadle, and his new movie, The Guard, opens up on July 29th at the Empire, Angelica, and Lincoln Plaza here in New York. Now, your character, in ways, seemed to me the toughest one because you're often reacting. Everyone else is completely out there, as we've been talking about, but yours, like in that scene we heard, a lot of what you're doing is waiting that beat and then responding.
Yeah.
What's that like to play for you?
It's fun. I mean, it was actually kind of, I'm often the active person in the scene. I'm often the one doing something to someone else and people are responding to my character. It's great to sort of sit back and just be. I mean, in this movie, he's kind of the whipping boy for everybody for a while. Until
he's being played by everyone.
By everybody. Until he figures it out that this guy is actually the guy he needs to stay the closest to. And it's just, you know, like I said, the script was so well constructed that it wasn't difficult. And John had such a clear idea about who these people were and the way that he wanted it to be done that I wasn't out there floundering. Like, I don't know how I'm just supposed to wait for this. It was obvious who I was, who Brendan was playing, and my lane, what my lane was, you know.
Now, I know you are a musician. I could hear you listening to the music as we got into this segment. And I wondered, as someone who has such deep musical roots, do you listen to the music of a script when you get a script? Is that part of what you're looking for, too? It's not just what the words say, but how they sound?
And that's a very good observation, and especially with a script like this and a movie like this where Brendan and I talked about it a lot. It felt like a composition. There's so much poetry and there's so much of a flow and a rhythm in how it was written that we didn't want to mess with it too much. You know, people have asked me, was there a lot of improv? I said, no, not a lot. I mean, the language really held together in such a way that you just wanted to service the piece as it was on the page because a lot of thought went into it. And there's that lilt that's in it. It's got a lot of musicality, and then it's great because my character comes in and he's kind of like a thud, you know. He's on the left foot. He can't quite find the beat, you know, until much later in the film, and then he's in the flow of it. So, thinking of it in terms of the rhythm of the piece, that's definitely was a lot of it.
And it sounds like as an actor, the music is part of the way you respond to a piece too. That I love that description of your character is the one who's on the offbeat when everybody's on the onbeat.
Yeah, so they're on 2 and 4, and he's on 1 and 3. And he can't find it, you know. But I think the best films, you know, the movies that sort of tend to just kind of weigh over, you know, just kind of flow over you, have that rhythm, have that real give and take between the characters, and even the way that it's shot, you know, the backdrop of this film being shot on the west coast of Ireland and that place, Connemara, that's so unlike almost any place else on earth, you know, is as much a character in the film as anyone else. And that's sort of that stark, open, broad kind of landscape that all this stuff plays off against.
From the first shots, that's absolutely true. And it is, to those of us in America, it's such an unexpected landscape. And I heard you say in an interview that it was also the wettest winter on record in like 300 years. What was it like to shoot? It's very bleak, but very compelling landscape.
Yeah. I mean, we were very, very fortunate because you hear something like that and you say, oh, we're going to be boned. We're not going to make our movie. You know, and it's a very small budget. We had a very tight schedule, you know, not a lot of wiggle room on days to get boned by the weather. So we were so fortunate. We had interiors, and when we had interiors, it would rain cats and dogs outside, and then we'd move outside and it would stop raining. I mean, there was only one day that we had to kind of do one scene that was supposed to be all night, and we had to cut it up and do it in two pieces. But everywhere else, we just really had the luck of the Irish, you know, we just kind of got through it. And in a movie like that, it's unheard of. And we knew that we were pushing it. My schedule was such that, and Brendan's schedule was such that we had to keep going later and later and later. We were supposed to shoot in the summer, and it ended up being in the late fall, winter that we could actually go. So we knew we were going to be kind of up against it weather-wise, but we didn't know it was going to be the wettest season in recorded history in Ireland.
Although that weather is perfect for this film, because so much of it feels very bleak.
Yeah. Very austere, very, very inhospitable. To my character, it was great because I was like, "What am I doing out here?" Wendell Everett never thought he was going to be stuck in that area. That was supposed to be a potential port that they were going to come to. It wasn't going to be the place the whole case was going to go down. So it was great to be a fish out of water in that scenario.
And at the end, there's a photographer who takes your character's picture and says, "Oh, you can use it for your book, A Fish Out of Water Story." Yeah. Isn't that what everybody,
yeah,
all
you
those
Yanks
Americans,
are always
right?
Making books, yeah.
Right. What was it like? I mean, you were, I would assume, the only American in this cast also. So in ways it worked well to get that feeling.
Yeah, it was, for me, like I said, everything sort of, you know, came together to make it the kind of experience that I thought was, you know, went hand in hand with what I had to play. There wasn't a lot of stuff I had to do other than just show up and be available and know my lines and, you know, follow John's direction. And all of that helped service the piece. I thought I was, everything worked for who I needed to be. And afterwards, you know, the cast, they took us all around and we went to the pubs every night and hung out. And I think there was never a night, no matter how late we shot, that we didn't go talk about the day's work and the next day's work and have a pint. You know, it was just a really great experience. My kids got to come out. It was,
oh, they did.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
I've often wondered about that, too. I mean, in radio, you put a team together and the team can often last for decades. But in the work that you do, it's like you have to come together as a team. You do this intense work and then, yep, you're gone.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, seeing Brendan here doing the press now is, you know, I've seen him probably three times in the past 6 months, and it's because we'll get together and go to Sundance and don't see you, and then get together and go to this festival, and I don't see him for weeks. But I still have a real big affection for him, and it's true. We make these sort of quick nuclear families, and we're together for 3 or 4 months, and then we may not see each other ever again. You know, it's a very vagabond way to live.
You were an executive producer on this as well as the star and one of the stars. What does that mean to be an executive producer? It probably means different things on different films. But
exactly.
For this one, what did it mean for you?
Well, for this one, it was just sort of in the beginning, it was just sort of lending my name not only to the cast, but also trying to just build momentum and sort of a groundswell interest in the film. And then going around and shopping it and trying to use whatever leverage we can to get the budget for these films. These smaller films, it's often harder to get the money together for than if you're doing a $100 million movie at a studio. So that's what it was in the beginning. But there wasn't a lot of script development necessary. There wasn't a lot of going out and finding the cast. John was very clear with who he wanted and the kind of film he wanted to make. Often when we come on that early, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of script development. It's, you know, we're going out and hiring the keys, the camera operator, you know, the cameraman and the set designer and the production designer and all of that stuff. But John kind of had that all in hand. Our part came, I think, later in the post-production portion of it with the music and the cut and the way the film would be rolled out and interfacing with the studio on that.
Why, as an actor, did you decide, I want to get involved in this piece of the business, too? What was it that drew you in to making those decisions about elements of a film that most actors don't really pay attention to?
Well, initially, the impetus for it was survival, you know, was to just not be an actor who's just always sitting there with my hand out hoping that somebody offers me a job, but to kind of be in control of my fate as much as I could be, and finding scripts that maybe had been shelved that hadn't been able to come together, and, you know, blowing the dust off of those and going out and finding a director, finding a writer to do rewrites, finding a production team, and just trying to start the ball rolling and put it together. And that's something we were able to do with Traitor. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, we've got a couple other movies in development that were similar situations, scripts that hadn't been able to find any traction. And you just kind of roll up your sleeves. Crash was another situation like that, where you just roll up your sleeves and say, I'm in, I want to see this done, and I want to be a part of it, and I'll take a, you know, a cut on the payment. I'm interested in the piece. I think it's important, and I want to push it through and see it get made.
I'm speaking with Don Cheadle, whose new movie, The Guard, is opening up on Friday at the Empire, Angelica, and Lincoln Plaza theaters. I mentioned music at the beginning, and I know that's a... In fact, I was just told that you were playing piano in the ready room before you came in. How did you first get into music? What was that experience for you?
You know, when I was very young, it was church. First, it was the choir in church, and my father sang in the choir, my mother sang in the choir, and the music of the church was just, you know, something that I really sparked to. And then we moved away from Kansas City, and I was in a whole new environment and didn't know a lot of people to begin with, so there was a lot of kind of downtime that I had with myself, my sister and I, just being together. And my parents always had music around, you know, it would be Motown compilations or some soul music. But I think the biggest influence I had was my parents had a recording of Porgy and Bess, of Miles Davis, and Gil Evans' Porgy and Bess.
Not the Gershwin, but the
Miles
Davis.
Not the Gershwin, the Miles and Gil version. And they also had a Cannonball Adderley record, Spectacular, and I played alto sax. And the old record players, you could play at, you know, 78, and you could slow down these solos so slow, and it was almost a complete, it was almost an octave.
Yeah.
So I could figure out what they were playing. And I remember, you know, coming home and transposing these solos and trying to learn them on the sax. And it just became this sort of obsession. I don't know why. I just had an affinity toward the music and wanted to understand what it was. And it kind of started then, I guess, in the fifth grade, jazz particularly. And it just kind of went on from there. I just followed it all along. And the friends that I made when I was in junior high school, they were all into jazz, and it just kind of never left me.
When did you make the decision that while this was a passion, acting was the direction you were going to choose?
You know, when I was in high school, I was pursuing both. I was in a jazz choir that was, you know, we were, you know, really successful and very good, and really great time in that choir. And I was in a jazz band. We were doing a lot there. And I was also in every school play. So I was doing all the arts. And when it came time to start looking at schools, you know, I wasn't that academic. I was an all right student. You know, in my senior year, I kind of decided that, wait a minute, I can do this stuff. So I kind of knuckled down and got my GPA up. But it was never really where my passion was. And I applied to several different schools, Carnegie Mellon, UNLV, UNC, and California Institute of the Arts. And I think after some hard winters in Colorado, I made a weather decision.
Said,
I think I'm going to go to Los Angeles and go to acting. Because the other two, you know, I had two scholarships to pursue jazz, vocal jazz, instrumental jazz. And, you know, the Carnegie Mellon and the CalArts scholarships were to pursue acting. And I said, well, I'm not going to go to Pennsylvania. I don't think I'm going to do that because I'm trying to get away from the winters. And I just went to L.A. and started working in my junior year of college and kind of never looked back.
The music that is coming back, I know you have a project on Miles Davis that you're trying to get made.
Touch wood. Yeah. Every day it's a grind. You know, this business has shrunk considerably, and especially movies in this range, you know, 20, under 20.
Under 20 million.
Yeah,
is that what you're
talking
about? Which you know, you said this before, but it's so ironic that it's harder to raise 20 million than it is to raise 100 million.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at a studio, it's almost unheard of to get a movie made for that. We see what they're trying to do now with the kind of movies that they're interested in, with the big tentpole summer movies. And if, you know, and I've been in a couple of those and in one now, so I'm not bemoaning them, but it's kind of tough when you're trying to do other things as well and just do a movie that just on its merits without being able to figure out how to vertically integrate it into a mug and a lunchbox and a toy and
a video game. So the music would be there with this one. So
yeah.
So that's
something you want. But, you know, it's very refined sort of particular specific music. I think we've seen that. We know that that jazz music around the country is struggling as well, and jazz musicians, incredible jazz musicians, are finding it hard to make a living, you know. So people see that and kind of go, oh, well, this is a bit of a refined piece, without having read the script, which is really not that.
And he's such an extraordinary, as well as being the most brilliant musician, an extraordinary character in terms of diving into someone who was complicated.
Absolutely.
And disturbing and compelling all at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great canvas to play around with, and, you know, especially, and people don't know a lot about him. You know, I think the general population doesn't know very much about him at all. So doing all this research has been a lot of fun, and now it's that hustle that, you know, that we try to do day to day with these smaller films, is try and find a home and convince somebody else that it's got merit.
What are you trying to do in terms of Miles Davis? I mean, that's a huge life. How are you capturing that?
By not trying to do his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think movies shouldn't try to do something that I think you could do much better on, you know,
in
PBS or a book, a 30-part series. So we're looking at 2 days in his life and sort of exploding everything else through those 2 days. And it's a period where he actually wasn't playing. It was a silent period in 1979.
Oh.
And it's a point in his life where his music was stolen from his house. And he goes on this insane quest to get it back.
How interesting to do a movie about a musician when he's not doing music.
Which is what a lot of the themes of it are, is how do you get back? How did you get here? You know?
I can't wait to see this. I hope you can raise the
money
to be able to do it. It also sounds like, would you play the main role?
Yeah.
So that would be an extraordinary opportunity.
I'll perform it for you at my house if it doesn't work
out. I'm there. That would be great. I think you'd have thousands of other people who'd want to show up for that one, too.
Well, if they'd all bring money, then maybe I could produce it for real.
Well, there are, you know, there are musicians who were doing that, who were saying, you know what, this is what I want to do. Put it in. And it's like the public radio model of making something. If you love this, please contribute.
It.
So $20 million is a lot.
Yeah, we'll pass the hat. We'll see what we get.
That sounds good. Well, Don Cheadle, thank you so much. It's been really quite a pleasure to have you here to talk about your new movie, The Guard.
Thank you. I'm glad to have been here.
The Guard is opening up this weekend at the Empire, Angelica, and Lincoln Plaza on Friday night. And Don Cheadle is one of a team of brilliant actors who performs in it. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.